Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your hosts, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows and Cody Kellum of Born and Raised Outdoors.
He looks back and he sees me getting the gun out of the waterproof case, the rifle. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, you said get the rifle. He's like, no, I said get to the other side of the river. And I look at him, I go, duh.
At GoHunt.com, our goal is to be the very best at what we do. We are constantly putting value and new information at our users' fingertips. It's our job to always go above and beyond for our customers. We don't want you to stress days of researching or paying hunting consultants to give you unreliable and opinionated information before your hunt. That's why we're giving you the power and ability to find exactly what you want when you want it. And with the introduction of draw odds and filtering 2.0, it's never been easier. So why wait? Join the movement today and start finding the perfect hunt for you. Go Hunt Insider, the new breed of hunter. Visit GoHunt.com/insider and join the movement.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I do not have Cody with me this week, though we should be able to get him back on soon. He's finished up with his Land of the Free project, and probably just decompressing from that one after a six-week stint of daily editing like a madman. So it'd be nice to get him back on. But today I'm excited. I've got Lane Walter on the line. How you doing, Lane?
I'm doing good, man. How about you?
Good, good. It's good to catch up to you again. I got a chance to meet you last year, I believe it was, when your father-in-law, Randy, came up to take a look at my foundation, which he put in for me. Geez, it's hard to even fathom that that was the very beginning of the, it was either end of last year or beginning of this year, but this.
Yeah, I can't believe it's been a year. I can't believe that, man.
Yeah, I just screamed right by, but hunting season has passed. Since the time I got to talk to you last, I'm excited to catch up on what you did. But for the listening audience who's not, familiar with you, why don't you kind of give us a quick rundown on your hunting experience, how you got into it, and then kind of what you've done since the time that you started.
I was kind of lucky. I was born up in Powell, Wyoming, and my dad was hunting up there. And so some of my earliest memories are going out deer hunting with my dad. And basically my dad would hunt and my mom would hang back with me and the rest of my brothers and sisters. And we'd kind of watch and have him go hunting. But then when I was around six or seven, we moved to Colorado and my dad didn't have anywhere to hunt and didn't really feel like going out and finding a new place to hunt. So I didn't get to go hunting until I was about 14, and my twin brother and I pressured him into taking us out elk hunting for the first time. And it was a lot of hiking in the woods with a gun. And then when I was about 18, I started bow hunting. And just from talking to some buddies, I grew up shooting competitive archery and started bow hunting. And that was more of hiking in the woods with my bow. And then, started reading a couple books about it, learning a little bit more, then met up with my father-in-law, who you were talking about, Randy, earlier, and I would attribute a ton of my success to everything he has taught me. The guy is a straight-up killer in the woods, and he taught me a lot, and I got my first deer when I was 19 with him, and then that same year, we went to Alaska and on Prince of Wales Island hunting black bears, and I didn't get anything. I was able to draw down on a bear, but I just didn't feel like he was big enough. And yeah, that was the start of a roller coaster and an addiction, I would say, to my bow hunting.
Right on, right on. And since then, you've kind of got on filming, and you've done some stuff there with a full draw film tour as well, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I started filming for Trevin Stolzfus with Outback Outdoors. He taught me, him and Dustin over there taught me basically everything I know about running a camera. And the way I got hooked up with Trevin is we would shoot a 3D league together, and he was looking for some guys to do some stuff, and he posted something on Facebook about he wanted a video editor. I was like, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, but if you teach me, I'll come do it. And he was like, well, I don't want you to video edit right away. I want you to be a cameraman since you know kind of how to hunt and you know what you're doing in the woods. And so he taught me how to run the camera, and I started working for him with Outback Outdoors and eventually branched off to where I still work with him at Outback Outdoors as a field producer doing stuff. But then I filmed for Eastman's with Brian Barney, and then I filmed for Willie Schmidt over at Pure Hunting, and then I've had a couple of my own small film projects. I had a film in the Full Draw Film Tour, and I just found out yesterday I got one in the ATA Show Film Festival coming up here in a couple weeks, and yeah, fun wow. stuff.
Nice. You're crushing it.
I'm trying. I don't feel like I'm crushing it. I feel like I'm just trying to get a foot in the door most of the time.
Well, that's what it takes is, you know, a lot of hustle, and then you get some traction and off to the races. But it sounds like you're kind of already racing, so that's good.
I'm trying. I just feel like I'm barely moving, but
Well, all right. That's it's a solid start. So, did you start out filming with a DSLR right out the gate?
Yeah, right off the bat. Then Trevin put a DSLR in my hands, and he put it on manual, and he put it on manual focus, and he told me, "You are not allowed." He goes, "You are not allowed to do anything else, but you had to figure out how to run it with this way." And I couldn't thank him more for that. I got some other buddies that like started filming AV mode or something, and they just don't want to get over to that manual mode. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate Trevin doing that and recognizing that, and making me run the DSLR in manual right off the bat.
That's a lot to wrap your head around, you know, right to start out with. I mean, because you keeping it in focus and the proper zoom and positioning and all that, that's a lot to think about right when you're starting out. But then thinking about, you know, your aperture and all that on top of that, and I hope you got a chance to do a lot of practice work before you got in front of a live animal.
Oh, it was overwhelming. And yeah, we got to do a lot of stuff. I was at the office all the time writing down notes. And then before, on that first hunt I went on, I was the third cameraman. I wasn't even the secondary cameraman, because he knew, hey, you've only been running the camera a little bit. And luckily, you know, I still got some good shots on that and just eventually started to grow before, I think it was 2 years before primary on a hunt for the cameraman.
All right. And so what are you shooting for a setup now as far as the camera goes?
Man, I just changed everything earlier this year. Thanks. I don't know if you know who Lance Banning is. He's a guy that went to Alaska with me. Between him and talking to some other guys, I switched over to a Sony setup. So I'm running a Sony AS7R Mach II. Okay. I switched over from a Canon, but that Sony is just awesome. It was an upgrade by far for everything. So I'm running that, and then I got a few different lenses with that one. My primary lens isn't the top of the line glass, but it's really good for run and gun. It's a 18-240, so it's got a good zoom on it to where I can use it for an all around. But then I like to shoot with the 55mm prime and a 16-35mm on there as well.
That's a collection of lenses right there.
Yeah, my wife was thrilled when I dropped all that money on those. But that setup is so awesome. I love it. I can shoot in 4K. It's a 42 megapixel camera, which is twice the size of what I was shooting with my Canon 60. So it's a really awesome setup.
And is that a full frame or a crop sensor?
Oh, it's full frame.
On. And now Sony, I haven't really kept up too terribly much with them. I had a brief discussion about the Sony cameras with Cody on the podcast the last time he was on a couple of months ago. But that, as I recall, there's a couple of different models that Sony's putting out. One of them's kind of geared more towards still photography, one more towards video. Is that right?
Yep. They make the A7S, which is geared more towards video, and then the A7R, which is geared more towards still photography. I was still upgrading going with the R. I just couldn't. I would have been downgrading my pictures going to the S as far as megapixels. Uh-huh. And I doubled going to the 7, to the R. So it made sense for me to go with the R, and I liked it. They have a really good in between the two, which is the A9. Uh-huh. But I just couldn't pull the trigger on that one. It was $1,000 more for the body than my $3,500 7R Mach 2. So I just couldn't trigger on that one, although after playing with Lance's, I'm kind of thinking about it still.
All right, boy, the technology just goes so fast. I mean, Cody was talking about, you know, being able to put apps on your camera, and I'm like, what? Apps on your camera?
Yeah, I have a time-lapse app on that camera. And I was messing with it filming for Willie out in Hawaii earlier this year, and it was really cool. It just did the entire time lapse right there on the camera instead of it was really cool to play with that. I still haven't used that to its full advantage, but it's really cool to not even need an intervalometer anymore.
Yeah, no, that's pretty sweet. One less piece of gear to pack into the woods.
Exactly.
So what is your, what do your lenses run? Are they Sony lenses or do you buy
No, I'm running all Sony lenses. I have not bought an adapter. I still kept one of my Canon lenses to, and I'm going to get the Megabones adapter to run that. But I've been, I switched fully over to Sony and I'm really liking the setup. So they're, here, I got one I'm looking at right now. It's not the G series. Their G series is like their super top end, but it's just right underneath it on those as far as all my lenses.
So what kind of cache did you have to, if you don't mind me asking?
I think this, the 16 to 35 is like a $1,200 lens is what you can find it for on B&H. That 55 millimeter is right in the $1,000 range. And then the 18 to 240 is in the, I want to say I paid $1,000 for that one. So, so it's doable and it's a lot of money, but it's not, their G series are dying. It's, you're looking at $2,000 a lens if you go up to their G series lenses.
And probably like going from your mid-range binocular to a Swarovski, it's a lot of cash and an incremental step up, huh?
Exactly, exactly. And the lenses that I'm running, they're still, they are Zeiss lenses. So it's still really, really good glass. Anyone that hunts and is familiar with Zeiss, it's great glass. But they, that G is just that tiny step more further up. And eventually I'll be buying some of them, but not right now.
Right, right. Yeah, you get over the heartburn of investing in the body and three lenses in one fell swoop. And then that, then you still have to get your mic and lots of batteries. And how's the battery life on that Sony? I've heard they kind of chew through.
Horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible, but I just have a bunch of batteries and they actually fixed that with the A9 and they just came out with the A7R Mach 3 and they fixed the battery on that one supposedly, but I just keep a bunch of batteries and I have a charger in my bag. And when I take one out, I just throw it on and start charging it. And I can still make a battery last almost an entire day if I'm conservative with my filming. But if I'm leaving the camera on, I'll kill it in less than an hour.
Yeah.
So just depends.
Yeah. Those, now have you dealt with like extended backcountry trips and, well, obviously on your Alaska trip, did you have this set up on your Alaska trip?
Yeah. I brought it with to Alaska and dealt with it on that. And I think how many batteries did I take? Probably took 89 batteries and I have a Goal Zero that I charge it with, and then I have the Goal Zero battery backup as well. So whenever I had sun, I was charging a battery, and then at night I would charge it inside the teepee that we had. So,
right on, right on. And you're running? Were you running Sony batteries, or are you running a third party battery?
Bought knockoffs. Not going to spend money on the. I didn't buy the cheapest battery I could get because I've had problems with that. But I just got on Amazon and bought the middle of the line battery, and they did great for me.
Right on. Good deal. And so did you run any back-to-back comparisons against that? I imagine the camera came with a Sony battery, right?
Yeah, I have three Sony batteries because I bought one from Best Buy and I bought another one off of Amazon just to try it. And I really haven't noticed a difference, to be honest.
No, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nothing more discouraging than when you buy a knockoff battery and you're getting 50 or 75% better life out of the factory battery than you do with a knockoff. But
and I found that with my Canons, I really love my Canon, my true Canon batteries. But so far, I've been really lucky on these knockoff batteries for the Sonys. I think the battery life is just so bad altogether that they can't make a worse one.
All right. Yeah, I've got a, I'm torn about what I'm going to do going forward from the video standpoint. I've got a Canon 60D that I use mainly for digiscoping and then my product photography here in my business. And then I've been hiring out third party for my videos for my hunts. And so we bring my camera along as a backup body. And then also, like I said, to use for the digiscoping with that cropped, sensor there, it works well for not getting vignetting in that scope where you see the insides of the scope on the peripheral of the frame there. But going forward, I'm working on hiring somebody to help me out here in the office and kind of manage some of the more technical stuff as far as some of the computer software stuff that I need to have done. And depending on what that person's skill set looks like when that person gets hired, if they do some videoing and stuff, I may need to step up my game from a camera standpoint and lenses. So I'm also just kind of a junkie, tool junkie, and the camera gear goes right along with that too. But it's one of those things. I mean, I don't think camera gear advances quite as fast as computers. But, when you buy yourself a laptop, a new one, and get top of the line 3 months later, it's, secondary. You could buy it for $500 less or something. So
don't say that. I just bought a brand new laptop.
Yeah, I know. It's painful. I just bought myself a Mac. The guy, Wes Smith, that did the filming and is doing the editing for, this next DVD project I've got coming up. He's working off of a Mac, on Premiere. And he just sent me a hard drive that was, has a bunch of the projects that he's working on editing right now. And of course, I plug it into my PC and it doesn't, I can't open it because it's formatted from a Mac. So I actually got on Craigslist, and I've been kind of watching Craigslist, picked up a used Mac for $680 that had like $3,000 in software loaded on there, including Premiere and Final Cut Pro and all that. And then some Office and some CAD stuff. And so really, I mean, even if I outgrow this laptop, I'll just be able to migrate over that software onto a new one, and then be right in bit, still come out ahead. So
yeah, good for you. That's sweet. That's a lot cheaper than I just paid for mine.
Yeah. There was two others that I missed pulling the trigger on. I kind of balked and was going back and forth, and one was 1200 and one was 1300. And I guess, I just had to tell myself after they sold out from underneath me, I was like, man, I guess that just wasn't meant to be. And then I found this one on Christmas Eve. And so I got up, 4 o'clock in the morning and drove down to Denver and met this guy and bought it from him. So it's like, nice. I'm not going to miss out on another one. So,
nope.
It all worked out well there, at least so far anyway. But hey, I alluded to the fact that you did an Alaska trip this year, and I talked to Randy. Randy came up a couple of weeks ago, and I got a chance to hear the story from him. But I'd love, for the benefit of the listeners, if you could recount that, moose float trip that you guys went on. And I'd love to hear from your perspective there as well.
Yeah, definitely. So, 2 years ago, we went to, what was that, 2016, we went up to Alaska for a caribou hunt, and that got us in good with these pilot to where we were able to book sooner and do a float. And so we booked for a do-it-yourself float trip, and the pilots dropped us off 100 miles upstream. It was almost 100 miles. It ended up being like 95 miles upstream. And so we flew into Fairbanks, got everything set up, and there was six guys that were going. And it was me, Randy, Lance Banning, my brother-in-law, Greg, who is my wife's sister's husband, and then two other guys, two of our buddies, Darren. And so our plan was to split up. We flew in, got dropped off. That night we camped out, and Lance Banning and I were planning on just basically splitting off from the group so that we would spread out and have a higher odds of tagging out, if that makes sense. Uh-huh. So the next morning, everybody woke up, and the four guys stayed back while Lance and I got in the boat right at sunup and started floating, which was it was fun for a guy that luckily Lance had some kayaking experience. Me personally, my only experience has been I'm a firefighter in Denver, and I have a swift water training. Uh-huh. So my experience as far as rivers and rafting and rapids has been in the water floating, not so much in the raft. So I was really bad at rowing. So that first 3 hours was kind of a trip, just learning what the heck we were doing on the water. but luckily it started out really, really soft, mellow water. And 3 hours into it, not even 3 hours into it, came around the corner, and there was a cow moose standing right there 50 yards away.
Wow.
And so it was really, really awesome way to start the trip. That cow had a calf with it, and then about a 2-year-old bull. And the area we were hunting, we were in an antler restricted area, so we had to have 50 inches or wider or have four brown tines on one side. And this guy was probably like 25 inches. Mm-hmm. So we knew he wasn't a shooter off the bat, but we got out, we docked the raft really quick, got off, threw up our glass, and we're looking, hoping that something else was with them, doing some calling, but they took off and it was just them together. And it was just a really good way to start the float. And we just basically floated all day that first day. Found a spot around 3 o'clock we were thinking about hunting in, and then turned around and the four other guys, Randy and Darren and Greg, were coming down the river, and we met up and they're like, hey, we didn't like where we got dropped off, so we decided that we're gonna just floating down. And they liked where we were at, so Lance and I were like, well, on the map there's a spot a mile down river that looks great, so we'll float down there and hunt there. You guys hunt here and we'll stay here for a couple days and see what happens. Well, when we got a mile down from where they were camping, we got out, started looking around, trying to find a place to glass, and looked up and saw another guy's set of hunters. The outfit that was dropping us off will drop three sets of guys on that river, and we were the last ones to get dropped off. And earlier in the day, we'd floated by one of the sets of guys. And so then we found the other set. So Lance and I were like, well, if we keep floating, we're going to be the first guys on this river.
Virgin country.
Yeah, and that's what we were all about. So we're like, let's start floating. And around 5 o'clock, we're like, okay, might be about time to find somewhere to dock it so we can at least camp for the night. And we come around the corner, and Lance goes, Lane. And I look up because I'm sitting there trying to figure out how to row this dang raft, and we're going through these to what at the first day seemed like rapids. On the last day, I wasn't even worried about those things, but the first day I was all nervous, and I look up and there's something furry digging like a madman into the side of the riverbank. And I look up, I'm like, what the heck is that? And at first I was thinking maybe a wolverine or something, because it was just a bigger body but not big enough to be like a mature bear. And this little grizzly pub just cub pops his head up and looks at me. I was like, oh no. And he's 20 yards away, 30 yards, like maximum 30 yards away. And he's on the riverbank, we're on the river. And I look at Lance, I go, where's mama? And on cue, she comes charging out of these bushes and comes up to the side of the river and just is doing a bluff charge. And she's smacking her paws up against the river. And Lance, it's loud because we're on the river, we're in this little rapids. I hear him say, get. That's all I hear. Uh-huh. Well, I'm thinking he's saying get the rifle. He's carrying a 454 Casull, so he's got a big enough gun. We didn't have bear spray, we just had our gun, so I thought he said get the rifle. Apparently he was saying get to the other side of the river, which I thought was kind of a duh. Uh-huh. But he looks back and he sees me getting the gun out of the waterproof case, the rifle. He's like, what are you doing? I was like, you said get the rifle. He's like, no, I said get to the other side of the river. And I look at him, I go, duh. And now the time the bear is sitting there just smacking the side of the riverbank looking at us. Well, the cub looks up and sees us. He starts running downriver.
Oh, no.
We're floating downriver at a pretty good pace. He's kind of pacing us running out. So then the mom's running down, looking at us, looking at her cub. And luckily he veers off and goes up into the bushes and she follows him. And Lance looks at me and goes, hey, let's not camp here.
Yeah.
I was like, let's not. So we keep floating. About this time it's starting to, sun's starting to go down. We're like, all right, we got to find a place to camp. We come around the corner and we look up and I see this black dot on the riverbank again. And as soon as I'm thinking it, Lance says, is that another bear? And I was like, I hope not. And I picked up my glass, and this time it was a big old boar grizz just sitting there doing the same thing for something on the side of the riverbank. And I was like, all right. But this time I wanted to get over and get my camera out because we saw him before he saw us. Mm-hmm. But once again, I don't know what's it with these bears sticking around these little rapids areas. I couldn't get the boat docked, so we got about 20 yards away and we didn't want to spook him too bad and be too close to him. So Lance just started talking to him, like, hey, letting him know we're there. He's like, hey bear. And he looks up and he sees us, and the first thing he does is just stand up on his haunches. And those things are I grew up in Yellowstone around bears, but man, it's been a while since I seen a grizz. And that thing was, he was big. He just stood up and started looking at us and just tilting his head from side to side and just got down, turned around, and walked off. He didn't care. But once again, we're like, oh, let's not camp here either. Yeah. So we kept floating. And we basically went probably another half mile, and it was so dark. We didn't want to be floating in the dark. Came around the corner. There was a cow moose actually in the river. So we pulled over to the banks, made sure there was nothing with her, and then made camp for the night right there. I know. Woke up the next morning, hunted around there, couldn't find that cow, couldn't find anything else. And it was still kind of early in the season for calling because I think we got dropped off on the 6th or the 7th. Started hunting the 8th, so then it would have been the 9th. And everything from what we were talking to Larry Bartlett and reading and stuff up there, he said around the 10th is when calling really starts to work. So we called that morning, checked it out, weren't in love with where we camped, so we packed up and started floating downriver again. And found a nice spot about 4 or 5 miles further downstream and set up. And when we were looking for a camp spot, we heard something walking through. And Lance got down and I got down and he was about 10 yards in front of me. And this really nice bull caribou walks out. And where we were at, we couldn't have a caribou tag and a bull moose tag at the same time.
What?
So, yeah, it's a restricted area. You can only have one or the other. You can't have both. Otherwise, that caribou would have been dead.
No kidding.
So instead, we just sat down and watched him, and he literally walked 5 yards away from Lance. So Lance pulls out his phone, and I had left the camera back because it's so wet there. I wasn't pulling my camera out as much as I should have been. Wow. And so we both pull out our phones and are just like taking pictures and video of this bull caribou 5 yards away from Lance. And he walks right by him, walks by me at like 10 yards and just walks off. So we're like, all right, that's cool. Let's camp here. So we camped there and called that night and didn't have any. We called in a cow moose and that was it. And then the next morning we woke up and started calling, and it was a rainy day. It was rainy all day the day before. And right as it started to break, then we were setting up, calling some more right out on the edge of camp, like literally 10 yards from the teepee on the riverbank. And Lance looks at me and goes, I think I heard a grunt. I was like, yeah, me too. And we looked up, and as soon as he said that, out of the bushes walked on the other side of the river, walked this bull moose just sitting there looking at us. We're like, holy cow, it's the third day this is happening. And he's looking at me and he goes, do you see four? I was like, I can't count four, man. He's like, I only see three on each side. He's like, yeah, me too. And he's got the rifle propped up on him. If we had counted four, that thing was going to drop. Lance took his stick bow and he was hoping to do it with a stick bow. But as soon as we had that bull in front of us, we're like, somebody's going to shoot. So our ambitions went out the window pretty fast as far as sticking to the arch equipment. We just wanted to get at least one down.
Right, right.
And this bull was only 90 yards on the other side of the river. So we're like, he doesn't have four, and we weren't comfortable saying he was 50 yards. So
50 inches, yeah.
Yeah, 50 inches. So we basically just set the gun down and started taking pictures. And then the bull walked off and downstream, and I looked at Lance. I was like, hey, go get your camera. He went and got his camera. We called again, and that thing turned around and came right back to us. And this time he walked within 40 yards, and I had my bow sitting there and I had my camera, and it sounded like a bunch of Chinese tourists there. It was just click, 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 click from the shutter. And he came within 40 yards and was sitting there looking at us, and I had my bow arrow knocked. I was like, he's 45 at most. So yeah, we just let him walk and took a lot of pictures and videos, which is really cool. It was a fun time to see it, kind of depressing at the same time. But so he walked away, and it was only 10 o'clock in the morning at that point in time. We're like, well, we called in this bull. I didn't see anything last night, and we could kind of see the area and glass it. We decided to pack up and float a little bit further down to a spot that we had picked out on the map that we really wanted to get to and hunt. And as soon as we had everything packed up, here came the other four guys from our crew. They're like, hey, we didn't like we were hunting. We called in a small bull, couldn't get a shot off on him. He wasn't big enough anyway. And then they seen another one and they're like, we're just going to keep floating too. So we all met up, started floating. And then we got to the spot where Lance and I wanted to hunt, and those guys kept floating. And so we set up camp, and the whole time we were setting up camp, we found a little peninsula area to set it up on. And we were just cow calling the whole time, just cow calling. Cause from what we were reading on these calling in these moose, you can call for a day to 2 days before a bull actually come in, but he'll slowly come in. So we're like, we'll just start calling right away. And took us a couple hours to set up camp. And then we walked to the edge of camp, and the whole time we were setting up camp, we could hear this hydraulic that sounded kind of like a bull grunt. And so like we perk our ears at first and we're like, oh, and we eventually found out it was that hydraulic. So we go over to where we were set up to actually call and hunt for the evening. And Lance turns to me and goes, I can still hear that hydraulic over here. I was like, yeah, me too. And then he turns around and goes, don't move. There's a bull right there. And at 80 yards away was this bull moose just sitting there looking around. And unfortunately, he came in from the downwind side and he had his nose up in the air. And we picked that nose up in the air. I could see four brown tines. I look at Lance, I was like, he's got four. He was like, what do you want to do? And Lance had the rifle sitting next to him. I had my bow sitting next to me. And with the bull having his nose up in the air with downwind, I looked down, I pointed at the rifle. I said, dump him. So Lance picks up the rifle and he hands it to me. I was like, no, dude, you dump him. It's your rifle. He's like, are you sure? Yeah. So I got the camera out, started filming, and Lance set up his scope, was leaning up against the tree, and he looks at me. He's like, you see four? I was like, yeah, I see four. Dump him. So he shot, and Lance put three bullets in that bull. I mean, in the time that in like literally 3 seconds, he had three rounds in that bull. Bull runs off, and with Lance shooting three times, I look at him. I go, did you hit him? And he looked at me. He looked at me highly offended in a very highly offended way and said, yeah, he's dead. I was like, all right, I'm just making sure. And then he goes, you saw four, right? And I was like, yeah, I think so. You saw four, right? He looks at me. He's like, yeah, I saw four. He's like, well, yeah, I was pretty sure I saw four, but, you know, it would have been nice if you saw four too. So we go over this little riverbank where the bull ran over. And we're finding a really good blood trail, and we get to the river expecting to see the bull dead on the other side of this hump, and there's nothing there. And we look across the river, and we look, you know, we're like, well, he maybe ran all the way across the river. It was, you know, 20 yards, 30 yards wide at that point. It's like, and he goes, man, I thought I hit him really good. He's like, I know the first one hit him good. And I was like, all right. So we're looking, and then we turn and we look downstream about 100 yards down. The bull had dropped in the river and floated 100 yards downstream. We saw an antler sticking up out of the ground. I don't know if you looked at my Instagram page or whatever. I took a picture of just sitting the way it was. The way we found it, all it was a big old moose antler sticking out of the river. Everything else is underwater.
Wow.
It was really awesome. So we get up there, and the side that's sticking out, of course, was the three brow tine side.
Oh, no.
Lance walks up to him and pulls him out. We saw that magical fourth, and all the relief was all the relief there, and we were high-fiving, having a good time. It was starting to get a little dark, so we just took a couple pictures, and then we're like, well, let's get this sucker over to the side of the river. And Lance is a big guy. I'm a big guy. We're like, yeah, we could probably get this guy up on the riverbank. And we tried for 5 minutes, and I wish I recorded that whole 5 minutes because it probably is pretty funny to look back at because we ended up butchering that guy in the river, and it was a nice cold process. We got done about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning.
Oh man!
Just basically put all the meat up on the riverbank away from it a little bit, and luckily with him floating 100 yards down, he was, you know, probably 150 yards from camp, so we didn't have to move him from camp. If he had died where he was, we would have literally been camping right next to the carcass. Uh-huh. So good thing that it fell in the river. And all the next day was spent. We were calling the whole time. We were messing with it and taking care of the meat and caping it out and taking care of everything. And it basically took a full day to get that thing taken care of. Hunted there the next day, didn't really have anything come in, so we just decided to keep floating and get down to where there was a nice little set of class 5 rapids on the river that we'd have mm-hmm. to pour around. And I don't know if Randy told, I'm sure Randy told you about their experience with the rapids.
Oh yeah.
So we'd only read about these rapids. I've never been on a set of class 5 rapids. I just knew we were going to portage around it. Well, apparently Randy and the rest of their guys didn't see it coming. They knew it was coming, but the guy that was in charge of the navigation had it marked at the wrong spot in his GPS. And so they said, well, maybe we got around it. And then they looked up and they were in the middle of it. So those guys went through the class 5 rapids with a fully loaded raft. Everybody got kicked out of the rafts except for Darren, who to this day will still brag that he rode the class 5 rapids. Randy and Greg popped their raft because they got caught in a little washer and it really jacked up the raft a little bit. So they lost a day drying out their gear and fixing their raft and stuff. And they got really lucky that nobody got hurt. So talking through through the satellite phone and then our inReach system, they told us, hey, make sure you guys know where that class five is. So yeah. Like, let's go get that class five. And if we kill another bull, we want to do it to where we're not portaging that 3/4 mile with the, with two bull moose to pack. Right. Just before that, it was starting to get dark, so we decided not to get up to it so that we didn't have the same situation they went through and camp that night. And when Lance was cleaning out his bowl, we saw the northern light started. So we basically stayed up all night taking pictures of those. Oh, and I guess it was the first time I'd ever seen them. It was awesome. And that was a good time. So we basically stayed up till 3 o'clock in the morning taking pictures, and Lance messing with getting all the hide and all the flesh and stuff off from his skull. So we slept in a little bit later than we should have the next morning. I don't think we got out of the teepee until like 7:30 or 8, and then went the extra quarter mile downstream and started doing the portage. And that portage would have only taken a couple hours if we hadn't dropped the raft and popped a hole in it while we were doing it. So we had to wait for that to clear. And then the other group of guys that were on the river with us hit the portage at the same time, and they came up. And so we talked to them and made it a whole day affair basically. And they planned on camping right after the portage. And Lance and I pushed the boat off right as the sun was starting to go down. And I think we floated for about 3 hours in the dark that night. At that point, we were comfortable on the rafts, and it was a really fun experience just to be sitting there floating. And I had a little raft, and Lance had a little raft. Instead of going to just one big one, we wanted to have two, in case we had two move down. And so it was really fun and peaceful to sit there and float underneath the stars and middle of nowhere. And every once in a while, we have a little raft come up and get through it, and then just keep floating, trying to find a good camping spot. And around midnight, we found a good camp spot, set it up. Woke up the next morning, started to hunt, and we called in Randy and Greg.
Whoops.
So in the middle of nowhere, we're still calling in other hunters, but luckily they're from me. And they're like, hey, we're camped a quarter mile away from here. Like, all right, we packed up and went over and met up with them, and they were in a really good hunting spot that they wanted to stay for the rest of the trip. And Greg had dropped a bull the day before that. Right there, and they'd seen some other ones. So Lance and I decided to just keep floating, and we floated for another 2 days, found a good camp spot, hung out, just tons of sign, and just all we saw after that were a bunch of cows. We never saw another bull after that. Saw the northern lights one more time on that last night of camp when everybody else had met up with us again, and it was a really, really fun trip, but we just never saw another bull. And that last day, we floated the last 20 miles out to the truck and made the 8-hour drive back to Fairbanks and flew home.
I'll be damned. Man, that sounds like a hell of an adventure.
It was a blast, man. I had so much fun. I wouldn't change a thing on that trip again, other than Lance and I really wanted to stay in that hunting spot at least one more day, and everybody else was kind of ready to get home. So I wish that we had stayed there for one more day. I kind of wanted to stay. I think if we'd stayed there for one more day, we would have for sure seen another bull. Whether he would have been legal or not, I don't know, but I think we would have saw another bull there.
Right on.
That's about the only thing I'd change on the trip. It was a blast, man.
So a few details for guys that, I think there's a lot of general interest. It's kind of a bucket list hunt there to go up and hunt Alaska, and then to be able to do a float trip and DIY. That's like, everything that a lot of guys want to do. So you guys flew in commercially into Fairbanks and then rented a vehicle from there, or did you?
Yep, we rented, we ended up renting a pickup truck and a U-Haul, one big box U-Haul to get everybody and all the gear and stuff there. And I think when we do it again, we're probably just going to get two pickups and maybe do a U-Haul trailer. I think that would be the best way to go next time we do it. That ride in that U-Haul van just sucked. Renting the trucks.
Then you dropped a vehicle at your exit point where you're going to pull out, and then drove back to Fairbanks, chartered a
not Fairbanks. It was just a little town that was 3 hours instead of the full 6 or 8 hours.
Gotcha.
And then so we dropped it off there where the pilots were, and the pilots actually, we paid the pilots to drive the truck up and drop it off and have someone else drive us back. So we had both vehicles at where we were going to come out at the river.
Gotcha. All right. So, man, floating like 90, 95 miles, man, that would be, that alone would be an unreal experience, let alone, you know, adding hunting into it.
Yeah, the trip itself was the adventure, and the hunting was just a bonus on top of it. The fact that we killed a couple moose was great. It was awesome, but it would have been a really fun, awesome adventure without the without even killing a moose.
Uh-huh. So on your rafts, what were the what kind of raft, you know, were you using?
We went with Larry Bartlett's rafts, and he runs what's called Pristine Ventures, and they make, he makes some really cool rafts. They're made for what he calls float dragon. Mm-hmm. So they're made for a little bit less water than what we had. The other two guys, the other two groups of guys on the trip or on the hunt that got dropped off were running a big Alaskan. And I think if we do it again on that river, which Randy has it booked again for next year, we're probably going to go with those big Alaskans instead of the, instead of those smaller Pristine Venture ones. They were great rafts, but for the bigger rapids that we were hitting, it would have been nicer to have a little bit wider boat with a little bit better float on it, if that makes sense, a little bit more buoyancy. So since that river, we're not worried about running out of. Now on the opposite, if we had low water, those big boats would have sucked.
Yeah.
And those little smaller drag boats would have been perfect.
Yeah.
But on this river in particular, we're probably going to go with the big Alaskan, is what it's called.
Uh-huh. So on those smaller rafts, what's the actual physical weight of them, and then what kind of payload could you put in them?
I'm trying to remember. So Lance and I ran a Legend and a Cork, and the Legend's bigger than the Cork. I want to say the Legend, you can hold 1,200 pounds fully loaded, and that raft was about 100 pounds. And then the Cork is around 50 pounds, and it can hold 800-ish. Okay. Like, my numbers might be a little bit off, but that's about where it was. Randy and then Darren, they both had the big Pioneer, and that's a really big raft. I want to say it was like 16 feet, and that thing is rated for about 2,000 pounds. Mm-hmm. So definitely enough to get two guys. Talking to Larry, he said two guys and two moose can fit on that. He's like, you'll be packed down. He goes, but you can make it happen. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what they were planning on if they were to have shot two, just run it that way. Whereas I really like the setup that Lance and I had, having your own raft. I had half the moose on mine. Lance had half the moose on his. It was that was a great setup. I would do that again if I were going into a little bit lower water setup. The Cork with the Legend was perfect because until he shot, we had everything packed onto that Legend, including the Cork raft. So we were floating on the same raft. And then after we killed him, we went to two different rafts.
Gotcha. All right. So were you renting those rafts then from from Larry directly or from the pilot?
Yeah. No, from Larry directly. He'll rent out the rafts and he sells them.
Okay.
So, but with us, we decided just to rent them just to see how they go and how everything was. And mm-hmm. I mean, they were great rafts. I found them from a recommendation from Brian Barney from Eastman's. That's who he had used the year before. And then Lance actually knew Larry from Cryptek. They're both hooked up with the guys from Cryptek.
Okay.
And so they kind of had mutual connections and talking to him. And so we had a couple guys recommending those rafts.
Right on. And then as far as clothing, with dealing with all that rain, what did you guys do for rain gear?
I was running a full setup with Cryptek. With Lance being hooked up with Cryptek, he got me hooked up with Justin over there, and he sent me a full setup of it starts with a K. Their Caldo, I believe. Okay. I'm butchering the pronunciation of that. Mm-hmm. But I was running their rain gear. I tell you what, it was fantastic. I've been in areas with crappy rain gear, and it really, really sucked, and that rain gear was awesome.
Right on. So, you know, if you're going to go back next year.
Caldo. Yeah, the Caldo rain jacket.
What gear did you use on this trip that you're going to be swapping out for the next trip?
The first thing is that raft. That's what I'd be swapping out on that. And then as far as my camo, man, I was really, really thrilled with the setup. That Cryptek stuff worked amazing. And the one thing I would swap out is Lance was wearing their new Altitude, and that stuff was sweet. I was wearing some of the older stuff, like the Valhalla pant, the Valhalla shirt. I really loved it. Something that Lance brought along that I'd never used before was a schmog, which is a fancy way of saying a fancy scarf.
Mm-hmm.
And that thing was amazing. Like that has completely changed my hunting game in cold conditions. I loved it. Keeping that neck warm was just a game changer. So my gear, as far as that, I wouldn't change it. The one thing I would change is my waders suck. My waders started leaking on day two. I would have spent more money on the waders, and I'm going to spend more money on the waders. Lance was running a set of Sims and didn't have any problems. I was running a $200 pair of frog togs, and they held up for 2 days, and then they started leaking on me. That sucked. So, having cold feet and 20-degree weather really sucks. So I would have swapped that out. Luckily, we had some for Christmas. My sister-in-law got me something called a seal skins, which is just a waterproof sock. That saved my life. they totally saved me on that. That was definitely a lifesaver, something I'm going to have on any other trip like that again. Because you live in your waders on that kind of trip. The only time I put my big, thick leather boots on was when I was at camp, just hiking around. And most of the time I was wearing my five-finger shoes around camp just because they were more comfortable.
So Lance's waders, those Sims, were they neoprene or were they rubber? Or?
No, they were neoprene, and they just held up better. Just a bit construction, and so that's going to be what I'm running on the next time.
As long and with were those ones like with a booty foot, or did they have a boot? Okay.
Yeah, they were booty foot, and they were wearing like a big boot over it. You know, a wading boot over those.
Okay.
And my wading boot was great. It worked out good. But that, those waders were horrible. I still need to send those back now that I think about it.
Yeah, sounds like it.
With a nasty letter about how horrible those were. Uh-huh. So, I changed that out. I'm trying to think any other gear. I brought a lot of rain protection for my camera gear, but everything is wet out there. And luckily, I had all my stuff in a hard-sided waterproof case that I got from Willie Schmidt, and those were awesome. Those saved my camera gear. I wasn't worried about my camera gear getting wet at all, but I left them in there a lot just because of how much weather we got. And I talked to Aaron Hitchens with Rock House a little bit through Instagram, and he said you need to have the hard-sided waterproof cases for your camera gear. And I'm glad that I was that I did that. Lance just kept his in a waterproof stuff sack, and he was never pulling this camera out because of that. He's like, hey, it's just a pain in the butt to get in there and get it out, whereas I had my camera clipped to the outside of the raft so I could just get it really easily after the first day.
Right on.
So that was nice. But I, as far as like my gear, that Kryptek gear held up great. And I really like the Kryptek gear I've been running. And before that, I was running Sika, and I wouldn't have traded a single piece of gear I was wearing. I loved it.
Nice. Right on. The for guys that are going for the first time, what kind of suggestions could you offer to somebody who's planning their, you know, a similar hunt that you went on?
Biggest thing is do some homework. Luckily, we got a really good friend of Randy's that had hunted with these guys before, and that's how we got hooked up with these pilots. But I've heard some horror stories of these pilots, and my father-in-law Randy actually 3 years ago got in just a horrible situation with a pilot that overbooked and flew out of Fairbanks. He flew him around for 2 hours and then dropped him off in a spot where they said they were in the middle of nowhere, where when they looked at their GPS, they're like, hey, we're only like 40 miles from Fairbanks. And then to like put icing on the cake, the second 2 days into the trip, a car full of kids from Fairbanks pulls up and camps right next to them. Like literally. And they walk over there. They're like, hey, what's going on? They're like, yeah, dude, you're a 40-minute drive from Fairbanks.
Oh my God.
So they got completely screwed over with just a bad pilot that overbooked. And so they called the guy up, he picked him up and took him somewhere else. Well, by then they only had a couple days to hunt. And then the guy didn't show up. He was like 4 days late picking him up. It had nothing to do with weather. It was just that he was not showing up. I was literally calling that guy every single hour on the hour telling him, hey, you got to go pick these dudes up. You got to go. And he was like, I'll get to it when I get to it. So do your homework. Make sure you're going with somebody that's recommended. And they did a little bit of homework on this guy, but it turns out he just overbooked and then wasn't the best person in the world to be with. So I wish I had the guy's name, because I would totally blast it out there the way that he treated him. I never do that, but I I would totally blast that guy if I could. It was just a horrible experience. I was on an elk hunt going to the top of a mountain to get reception so I could call this dude. And I had other people calling this dude like, you got to go pick these guys up. They are out of food. They were literally eating grayling. That's all they had to eat. So it was a bad situation. Really bad situation.
Unreal. Man, yeah, it's kind of scary when you're, you know, carving off a couple of weeks of vacation time and spending thousands of dollars, you know, to go up there on a dream hunt. And you know, some guys, that might be the only time they get to experience that. And then you get, you know, that kind of deal, man, that could really be a life changing, you know, experience as far as going from a really good hunt to just a hellish nightmare.
Exactly. So find a really good bush pilot to go with. I know Larry does some stuff where he actually hooks you up with everybody and does a lot of the coordinating, tax a little bit of money on. But if you have no contacts up there and no like background and how to find something, that would probably be a really good way to do it. And then finding guys like that.
Is he still doing that? Cause I thought I'd listen to a podcast, that Aaron, Ryan Avery had done there on his, that Larry was saying he wasn't really doing that anymore.
I mean,
that
was, he might not be. I know on his website earlier last year, it said he was booked out doing that through 2019.
Boy.
So it might've just been too popular for him. I mean, I didn't even get to meet him when we were up there. He left everything on his front porch and said, wrote on it, this is for you guys and these boats are for these guys. He's like, I'm hunting. So you know how it is being in the hunting industry. If you sometimes you don't get to hunt as much because you're trying to sell stuff and it's not, you know.
Right.
I like his attitude of just shutting down shop during hunting season and going hunting.
For sure. No doubt. That's I mean, geez, the way the years are clicking by, you gotta get out there and do it or you're just gonna be, you know, living with regrets as you get older.
Exactly.
Yeah, I did a moose hunt up there in Alaska. It was a similar kind of well, it wasn't a float trip. We got flown in and dropped at a lake, and then we, you know, backpacked from there. And we had a small raft, 2-man raft, but it was a real small one. It was a 660-pound payload raft that we had back at our camp at the lake. And there was about a quarter mile from the lake. There was a small river. It was more like a big creek than it was a small river, but it flowed by the lake there. And so we hiked up, I think we were 7 miles from the lake when I shot my bull on day two. And then we spent the next day packing mine to the river. And then, we got up the next morning to leave to hike back to get the raft, and I spotted another bull and my buddy shot that one. So now, you know, 4 days into the trip, we got two moose that are dead that are 7 miles from our camp. And then, you know, a quarter mile portage from the river to the lake. And so we spent the last 8 days of the trip packing moose meat the whole time and literally got the last load to camp the evening before the pilot came to pick us up.
I'll totally believe it. Those things are so big and there's so much meat, and I've packed a ton of elk, but man, you get, it's like packing 3 elk almost. It seems like it's just a ton of meat, And with having to take every single scrap of meat up in Alaska, I mean, yeah, it's amazing how much you add on there with just that rib meat and everything.
Yeah,
so
for sure. It was an awesome experience though. I mean, when that float plane flies away, you feel very small and insignificant way out there in that country, knowing that, you know, I mean, we were like 100 and what we were probably 2 to 250 miles north of the Arctic Circle, where we got dropped. And I mean, we were way the heck up there. And, yeah, I mean, it was an amazing experience and got to see country that, you know, probably nobody had walked on before. That's a pretty neat experience when you spend that long of a time. We were up there for 12 days and never saw another person, you know, occasional, maybe once every 4 or 5 days, see a float plane buzz by in the distance.
Yep.
But, you know, and that was before the days of the InReach, and we didn't have a sat phone. We had an aircraft radio. So if somebody would have, you know, if something would have happened in 4 or 5 days, we might have been able to catch a float plane flying by in the distance. But yeah, pretty neat experience for sure.
Oh, that experience, and you talking about that feeling of when the plane flies off, I talk about a little bit in a film from my caribou hunt from last year where you feel so small and you're so far away from medical care. It just puts everything in perspective to where just a small little slip to where if you were hunting in the backcountry of Colorado, like, yeah, you can get out. Something's going to happen, but you do it there, it could have some big consequences.
No question. No question about it. So you're heading up back up next year?
You know what? Randy has it booked for 4 guys, and I'm up in the air as to whether I'm going or not. I want to do it, but at the same time, I haven't really spent any time elk hunting in the past 3 years.
Oh yeah.
The past 2 years, I have a total of 5 days in the elk woods combined. Oh, so which is painful. And then I've got 12 Colorado points, so I can draw the unit I want to draw here in Colorado. And I'm up in the air as to whether I'm going to take the time to go up there again and burn my entire hall pass again with my wife to do that. Or if I'm just going to stay here and focus on that deer tag and then elk and then try and do Lance and I are talking about going up there late October and doing like a Sitka blacktail hunt on Kodiak. Okay. So I'm up there. I'm probably going to Alaska one way or the other. Right now I'm leaning towards doing the Kodiak hunt just because it's something different. It's fun. Never hunted blacktail. That first time I was up on Prince of Wales Island, I saw a ton of blacktail. I wasn't even knowing what I was looking at. It was like my first real year bow hunting and didn't know I was looking at some good bucks. So it'd be fun to go chase some of those.
For sure.
So I gotta get that figured out pretty fast. I've talked to a couple pilots up there about doing it and trying to figure out a couple ways of how Lance and I could do it because he's going to be deployed and get home in time to where he can't do the Alaska, the float trip for moose, but he'd be able to do that trip. So I got to get that figured out of what I'm going to do.
Yeah. How have the winters been up there on Kodiak? I know that the quality of the hunting up there is pretty much, largely contingent on how bad the previous, several winters have been as far as winter kill goes.
I haven't checked it this year so far to see how it's going, but last year it was pretty good. And I had a buddy, Tyler Boschman, go up there and do a cut, and they killed some great ones. Then my buddy Mike was up there last year, and they killed 2 bomber blacktail. So far it's looking like the herd's pretty good.
So are you going to do a boat hunt or a fly in, drop off, and then hike?
There's one place that Lance and I are looking at where they do the boat, and then another one where it would just be the flight in. So we're trying to get that figured out. If we can talk our wives into going, then we're going to do the one where we're staying on the boat and doing that. Mm-hmm. But if they don't go, then we're going to end up just doing it where we're getting dropped off and going into the teepee again.
Right on. And you're using what, a Kafaru?
Lance is hooked up with Aaron from Kafaru. He's one of their, he calls him the bro staff.
Right on.
So so we were using that Kafaru teepee with stove, and I tell you what, man, that was a game changer. I love that stove. That stove at night, just, well, everybody else is in a little pup tent on that trip and they're miserable by day 10. Lance and I were nice and cozy. The first day, those guys were making so much fun of us for sharing a tent. Uh-huh. And making fun of that teepee. And they're like, oh man, we're like, well, there's a lot of room for activities in there. It's a great setup. And oh my God, dude, that thing. By the last day of the trip, everybody was inside our teepee warming up in the morning and drying their stuff out. They were eating all the words that they said that first day and making fun of our teepee. So it was, I tell you what, man, that thing was phenomenal. I love it. I will not be going on a trip like that again without a teepee and a stove set up like that. It was a game changer. I loved it.
And you didn't have a problem up there finding firewood that you could get to ignite in that
damp climate? Yeah, no, we were finding, there's enough overgrowth to where when it was really raining and really wet, we were just getting underneath and finding stuff that was dry enough that would light.
Right on.
And then we were stacking wood inside the teepee, so the wet stuff was actually drying off while we were burning the dry stuff.
Right.
So, and then by the next day it was dry enough to where we were burning everything. The problem was we never camped in the same spot longer 2 nights. Yeah. So we were just continually moving, whereas we were hoping to set up and stay somewhere for like 6 or 7 days. That never happened.
Yeah. So are you, Were you using like a piece of Tyvek as a ground cloth or something like
that? Yeah, actually, I took up a Slumberjack tarp. They make a tarp called the Satellite Tarp. I'm hooked up with them. I run their packs, and then when I'm in a spot where I can run their tents, I'll run their tents and stuff. But they make something called the Satellite Tarp, and I actually laid that out, and that was money. Dying okay. Just to lay down on that, so I had a little bit of a water barrier mm-hmm. in case anything were to happen with that floorless teepee.
Right.
So
it keeps a little cleaner on the inside.
Exactly. Too. It kept my sleeping bag clean. It was nice. I had just a little area to put everything down on, and that Satellite tarp was the perfect size.
Were you using one of those like lightweight backpacking cots, or were you just sleeping directly on the ground?
No, I have a. I have a sleeping pad that's a blow-up pad, but it has down inside of it. Mm-hmm. And the name is slipping me right now. I don't know why I can't think of the name of that thing, but I love it. It is the best sleeping pad I've ever had. It blows up to where it's like 2 inches thick. And between that down in it and X-Ped, that's who makes it.
Okay.
X-Ped. Mm-hmm. And they're actually made – their stuff is geared towards mountaineering, climbing to where you're sleeping on the snow. Yeah. So I definitely did not get cold sleeping on that thing. It was awesome.
Right on. Right on. Well, hey, I wanted to, while I had you on the line, do a little self-serving. Me being new to Colorado, you haven't lived here longer. I've hunted Colorado quite a number of years, but I'm curious, you know, kind of picking your brain just in general terms on, you know, hunting here in Colorado and kind of untangling some of the regulations and some of the opportunities that might not stand out to a guy that's coming to hunt, you know, maybe Colorado for the first time, as far as, you know, opportunities for the B licenses for elk or deer where those exist.
Yeah, man. So the first thing I would say to people coming to Colorado, if you're going to come here for the first time, you're going to make it like a good hunt, I would put in for a point or two, or at least draw a unit to where you're not doing an over-the-counter unit. The amount of people I see in an over-the-counter unit versus a draw unit. In my unit, I can draw 70% of the time with no points whatsoever. So I'm hunting that majority of the time. I see nobody. And then I go to the unit, which is literally right next door, which is over the counter, and I can't get away from people. I mean, 2 years ago, my buddy and I parked the truck at 4 a.m. and hiked until 6 p.m., just nonstop hiking, and we still ran into guys. So it's just the amount of people you get in over-the-counter unit. They're good. You can still kill nice animals in over-the-counter unit. That trip, we called in a 340-inch bull, and my buddy missed him twice. It was his first time ever bow hunting. His first night bow hunting. I called this bull. He shoots at it at 40 yards twice, and both times clips the same branch. Oh. Yeah, it made me sick. I've never shot at a 340-inch bull. No, I called this thing in for my buddy, and we're walking up to find his arrows. He goes, probably won't see another one like that this trip. And I look out and go, you'll be lucky to see another one like that in the next 5 years. Oh. So they're out there. You can kill, and there's elk out there, but I mean, it's just a lot harder in that over-the-counter unit. So my first tip would be get a draw unit if you can. Even if you're buying a leftover tag, you're going to be competing with less people then. And then as far as going into the B licenses and stuff, I'm not the most well-versed in it. I know a lot of guys that will draw the B tag. Most of the time it's a cow tag. Uh-huh. And so I haven't had to buy the cow tag as often because I've been lucky enough to where either me or my wife is tagging out. My freezer's full, and I'll just go hang out with my buddies and film them hunting instead of me going and just filling my freezer with meat I'm not going to eat.
All right.
So, but the B tags are like, that's something I'm going to start looking at a little bit more, seeing as how I usually burn up my A choice in the archery season and getting extended into the rifle season a little bit more. If I know with the B tag, you can get out on the Eastern Plains, and I know some guys that found some elk herds out there. If you get down south by Colorado Springs, you can get on the other side of I-25 where there's still a good healthy elk herd and going that route. But
yeah, I've got to start looking into that. You know, having been a non-resident prior to this season here, I just, you know, put in for my draw mule deer, and the years that I did, I just got an over the counter for elk and never, you know, even considered or thought about a bee license just from a time constraint. But now being a resident here, or, you know, if you're one of the guys that are fortunate enough to, you know, be able to take a full 2 weeks on a hunt, then looking into a bee license could make some sense.
Yeah, and I'm helping a buddy up in Canada that's planning a good trip down here to where he wants to make the focus being his deer tag, but then he also wants to find a unit where he can get it like a Class B elk tag as well and have that kind of as a secondary. So it's a really good option to have when you're doing it and looking at it.
Yeah, that's something fun to play with. Have you done much bear hunting here?
Yeah, I've killed two bears in Colorado. My wife's killed a bear here. Up where I hunt, I'm in the northern section of the state. 2 years ago, I couldn't walk 10 yards without kicking a bear, it seemed like. Wow. And the past couple of years, I haven't seen a single bear out there hunting. But where we're at here in between Loveland and Estes Park, mm-hmm. Yeah, you can. I've seen a ton of bears in there. And there's just with our population, it seems like we have a very good abundance of bears here in Colorado with us not having a spring hunt has really, you know, helped that population flourish.
Yeah. And then not being able to hunt them with dogs.
And then, yeah, you can't hunt them with dogs. I mean, it's you are spot and stalker calling them in. And I don't know anybody that calls them. Everything has been spot and stalking for us, mostly with the bears. Like mine was my father-in-law, or I think my mother-in-law had killed an elk in that area, and a bear had been on that carcass. So when we started hunting that morning for elk, we just made our way that way. And I was calling because all I had was a bear tag. Mm-hmm. So I was just back calling for my wife and father-in-law. And I ended up spotting that bear and stocking up on him and getting him. He was a pretty good sized bear. I think that was 2012.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've never had a, well, prior to this, geez, I'm trying to think here. I don't think I got a bear tag this year. I bought just being a new resident. And it was like, after buying non-resident tags for so many years and paying, upwards of $600 for an elk tag, when you're paying resident fees, it's like they're almost giving them away. So I got every tag that I could get, whether I intended to hunt them or not.
I do that every single year. I haven't hunted antelope in 3 years, but I've had an antelope tag every single year. And the same with bears. I haven't seen a bear in 3 years, but I buy a bear tag every single year. It's like $35. Yeah. I figure at the very least it's going towards something that I love and support and something. So I always put my money in towards it here in Colorado. Right. And it's always nice to have in your back pocket in your archery unit when you're elk hunting.
Yeah, no, I think it's great, support the fishing game, or game and parks or whatever division that you have there. And then you never know when you might get a last second invite or something like that.
Exactly. I wish they'd do it with a mountain lion tag, because with the less bears we've been seeing, more guys have been seeing mountain lions in the area that I'm hunting. So it'd be nice if we could do that, but we can't do that yet.
So are you able to, I haven't looked at that. Is mountain lion a draw here in Colorado?
No, it's over the counter, but it's with a cap. So, okay. And from my understanding of it, they cap it usually on females getting killed. Some units will have like a tom cap, but mm-hmm. There's so many cats here in Colorado and once again, you can actually hunt them with dogs, but for the most part, like, it's not something a lot of people put a lot of effort into. So that quota is rarely getting hit. And last year my wife was able to get a good tom, and my father-in-law was able to get a good tom, or a good female that was, mm-hmm. I think they aged that thing out at over 10 years old. Wow. Her teeth were falling out. They didn't think it was going to make it through the winter. And she was a mean old girl. So that's why he dropped her. But so he killed a female in that unit, and they took it in, and they're like, sweet. Like, we're still five away from the quota and the season's almost over. Yeah, so right. Yeah, but the thing is, you're not allowed to hunt them during any other rifle unit. So you have to be going out. The mountain lion season doesn't start until till fourth season rifle is over.
Right, so December kind of time frame.
It starts in December. So unless you have like a Class B cow tag for private land, then you're not going to be hunting elk at the same time you're hunting mountain lions. So you're not going to be seeing them in a time you can shoot them. So
sure,
we're not hitting that quota.
Yeah, I think it seems like in states that have quotas, I don't know that you really hear too much about lions getting to their quotas. There just seems to be so many of them. And it's interesting. There's such a misconception about, like, you never see them, you know, so everyone just thinks like they're borderline extinct.
Oh yeah. You never see them, but they see you, man. They definitely see you. Yeah. And it's funny. I knew that there was a lot of cats in the area, but until I was actually out looking for mountain lion tracks last year and following mountain lion tracks, and then you're crossing like three different sets of three different cat tracks that were made that night. Like, okay, there's a lot of cats here. And same thing down in New Mexico when I filmed that hunt on the Floridas. We only saw one mountain lion, but every single night we were walking on this riverbed in the sand, and the next morning our tracks were covered in mountain lion tracks every single day. So you weren't seeing them, you just knew they were there.
Yeah. It's a shame that there's not more guys that, you know, run hounds there to help control that population. That they put down a lot of deer, the lions do.
Oh yeah, they really do. It's funny. A lot of guys, like, they see this stuff and everybody's making a big stink about these wolves, but some of the studies of what the wolves are killing versus what the mountain lions are killing just as much.
Yeah.
So it's everything's going to compete. Everything's going to even out as long as we have a manageable situation for the wolves, which is where it's going up north. But those mountain lions, they kill a ton of fawns every year. Just a ton.
Yeah, no doubt.
The mortality, I think they said that one tom can kill like 40 mountain lion calves or 40 elk calves in just like that period of where they're dropping. I mean, so it's a ton.
Yeah, that'll really skew their numbers on fawn or calf recruitment.
Yeah, on calf recruitment. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ay, ay, ay. Well, getting back to your to the filming, and I never did dive into you on the editing part. I kind of got so caught up in the camera gear. Are you using Premiere?
I'm using editing? Premiere Pro. I got Trevin to thank for that. He had a Grady helping him and stuff. I don't know if you've ever seen anything from Grady Rawls.
Oh yeah, no.
I know Grady helped him and really pushed that. And I don't know if Trevin was running it before or not, but I know Grady runs it, and that's the only thing that he runs, and that's the only thing that Trevin runs. So luckily, right off the bat, that was the only video editing process that I became familiar with, and luckily it's the most complicated, so I just started once again, right in the deep end. It's a fun, it's a great setup. I like doing it. Premiere's great.
Watching time disappear right in front of you when you get down, you know, sit down in front of a computer and start editing, man, just like hours turn into minutes.
Oh, just to do like a 2-minute clip, you're going to have, you could have 8 hours into it easily. It's crazy how much time. And if you're linking audio, then that's a whole other nightmare. And luckily I've upgraded my camera equipment to where I'm recording the audio on a separate device, but it links it directly into the SIM card where I'm not linking audio anymore. But yeah, it's a time consuming process.
So what are you shooting or using for your audio recording then? Are you you're not running a camera mic, then you're running something?
So I'm running a shotgun mic, but then I'm also running a Sony wireless mic setup that's plugged into what's called a Beach Tech. Okay. And the Beach Tech is plugged into my camera. So the Beach Tech is an amp, and it's capturing all the audio from the wireless mic and then recording it directly into the camera.
Okay.
So it's just basically making my camera a little bit better quality and able to capture that wireless mic with the XLR output instead of just having the one input.
Okay. So you've that Sony does have an XLR input?
No, the Beach Tech mounts to the Sony camera.
Okay.
And then
so it acts like a splitter essentially.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It splits it basically to where I can have the XLR output.
All right. So does that screw into the bottom of your, where your, tripod screw is there?
Yep. And then the tripod actually mounts to the bottom of that. And it's just a nice way to add four pounds to your camera.
Nice.
And actually this year with what I was filming and up in Alaska, I only ran that for the first couple of days because audio wasn't my main goal on running the camera up there. And it was so wet, I didn't want to ruin anything with it being brand new. Mm-hmm. So I didn't use that a whole lot. And then on my wife's mountain goat hunt, she had a mountain goat tag here in Colorado. I was guide first video second. And wow. So I ran that for the first couple of days, but it was negative 20 and I was just killing bad. So the day that she actually killed it was the first nice day. I didn't take it up. And I was just back to the shotgun mic. So that's more for when I'm actually getting paid to go out and film for guys, when I'm hooking that up and using it. It just makes whoever's editing it, which most of the time I'm not editing what I'm getting paid to film, because that's a huge time consuming process to do an entire TV show. So it just makes it life easier for the guy that's doing it. And they thank me for running that Beach Tech instead of what I used to do.
Yeah.
To go through and link the audio.
Right. Yep. Then you have, you're recording on separate tracks on the shotgun and the, I would say that whoever's hiring you is probably really appreciates the time that you spent, on the editing end. Once you start playing around with editing, you realize what you didn't shoot in the field, you know, and what you need to shoot the next time you go out, as far as transitions and all that.
Exactly. A transition is a time lapse. Once again, I have Trevin to thank for that, and doing a couple of the film schools with him, where if you don't really know what you're doing with the camera until you're starting to mess with the post editing and putting it all together. And that really makes you appreciate everything that you have to do and make sure you don't forget those shots.
Right.
Having that shot list.
Is he still doing those film schools, or did he hang that one up?
Well, he didn't do one last year, but we did one the year before that. I got to talk to him, see if we're going to do it again this year or not.
Yeah.
So I think it just comes down to time and, you know, life just gets in the way of everything, and getting all those shows edited out and stuff. I know it put kind of a burden on Dustin, who does all the editing, and Dustin and Garrett. Yeah. So.
Yeah, boy, every time I've seen Trevin's Instagram feed this fall, something else was hitting the dirt. He had a busy year this year.
Man, he's had a great year, but he spent a ton of time away from home. I know that.
Yeah.
So, but that's just, you know, the trade off of it. But yeah, he's had a really good year.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Well, where can people catch up to you on social media? What's your handle there?
Instagram is my biggest thing. R2 Lane, just letter R, number 2, LANE.
Okay.
Keeping it simple on that. And then Lane Walter on Facebook, if somebody wants to find me on there. And I'm getting ready. I got all these films that were, you know, in full draw 2 years ago and stuff that I haven't put out online. So I'm actually getting ready to release a couple films on YouTube and Vimeo and Facebook. So look for, I don't know when you're going to post this, but I'm hoping to do that within the next couple weeks. So I'm going to try and post my caribou hunt from 2 years ago here in the next week or so. I'd like to get that out before ATA show. And then after ATA show, my mom's mountain goat hunt, I'm going to actually post that and make that public, because I've just been sitting on that for 2 years, it seems like.
All right.
So, and then I've got a couple other small ones that I'm going to throw out there and start working on some more stuff. So yeah, I do have a YouTube page. It's only got one real film up there right now. So
all right. What's your YouTube page?
Just Lane Walter.
Okay. Excellent.
It might be Lane Walter Productions. I don't know. Right. That's how much I'm on it right now. I just got all these films I'm sitting on. I've been talking to a couple different platforms about getting my films up on there, and I've been thinking about doing the DVD route, but I think for right now, I'm just going to post some stuff on YouTube and just let it roll from there and not charge people for it yet, because then I got to really make sure I'm buying more film permits when I'm doing that. Luckily, so far, when I go out and I'm filming something and I talk to the people at the National Parks office and I tell them what I'm doing, they're like, well, no one's really paying you for the film. I'm like, well, no, not yet. It's all coming out of my own pocket. I get product, and luckily, so far, everybody I've talked to, the only time I've had to buy a film permit was with my mom's mountain goat hunt. So, and then Slumber Jack paid for that anyway. So they're like, hey, you got charged for it? Okay, cool. We'll pay you for it. Cool. So that was nice. That was really cool of them.
Sweet. Yeah, it definitely complicates things when you're having to deal with film permits. And
man, I wish they would pass that law. And I know they've been working on it for 2 years, to where we just pay that $250 to get it done, instead of, I mean, I pay $250 per day I filmed on my mom's mountain goat hunt.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous how much that eats up when you actually start paying for it, and huge pain and the headache of the paperwork to do it anyway.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous. I mean, it's a shame that Congress is like stuck in molasses as far as getting anything done. And I'm sure that this, you know, that film, that, you know, that bill is probably at the very bottom of the list for as far as priorities go with everything else. And then the further, more time that passes, the further down that list it goes.
Exactly. Well, the problem is everybody likes it, but then they try to tack on stuff that people don't like. Right. And so they're like, oh, okay, so Republicans and Democrats really like this bill. Let's get it pushed. But then a Democrat will try and tack on something, or a Republican will try and tack on something that's completely out of that realm and under their ball field, which is just a pork budget thing. And then people are like, oh, I'm not voting for that. Right. So it never goes anywhere, because if people could actually just focus on something and get it done without trying to do something in left field, it would go a lot smoother, but they just can't do it, man.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, pretty frustrating. I mean, one time 20 odd years ago, ran for one of the political, or one of the, offices of the our local archery club, and that was for the short time that I did that. I can't remember what it was, VP of hunting or something like that. It was like, wow, if this is what politics is like, I want nothing to do with it.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more with it. The only thing that keeps me in politics is what these politicians are trying to do to our public lands, whether it's one group wants to just completely develop them and sell them, and the other one wants to take your guns away. So you can't win with either one. But I mean, just trying to find something in the middle. If they just did what was best for the public lands, that's all I care about at this point.
Right. Yeah, I like that Randy Newberg's the political party of hunting and fishing.
I tell you what, dude, the Bull Moose Party back from Theodore Roosevelt, somebody brought that back where it was fiscally conservative but cared about conservation. I would vote for it probably 99% of the time. That's what I care about. I want fiscally responsible, and I want you to just leave my public lands alone. Just leave it protected. Don't touch it. Don't jack with it. Don't let a mining company from Canada come in and mine next to these headwaters where it's just going to completely ruin it. Sorry, no, I don't want that. Not on my public land. Go do it on your private land.
Yeah.
And don't sell it to them. Don't say okay and then sell it to them. Just keep it.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. Well, Lane, I appreciate your time on the podcast here. We'll work on getting this up hopefully over the holiday weekend here. I haven't talked to my editor in a bit, but hopefully he's got a few minutes free and can get this posted up. And for 2018, I hope that you're able. Oh, if guys are interested, say somebody wanted to hire you to film, is that something that you're doing, or you've got your hands pretty well full with the contacts you've got?
I tell you what, I'm just picky on what I do, and it depends on what time it is. During September, unless it's like a doll sheep hunt, good luck. Uh-huh. But Willie's been really awesome with Pure Hunting. He goes on these really cool hunts during different times of the year, and I can usually carve out time at different times as long as it's not around my hunting season. So I got something on my website. I do have a website, which is lanewalter.com. There's a contact form on there that they can hit me up through, or they can just shoot me an email at r2lane@aol.com. I'm always looking for fun stuff to go do and extend my season. That's why I really got into the filming. One, I loved it, but it extended my season from just my archery September season, September. I'd spend the whole month in the woods and I'd be depressed for a couple of months because my hunting season was over. Now it's just a way of extending my hunting season.
Being a junkie and getting one fix a year.
Exactly, man. And I tell you what, I love being behind the camera just as much as being pulling the trigger myself. It's just as fun, if not more fun, for me to be behind the camera.
The filming that I've done, man, I've really enjoyed it. And for somebody who has never filmed before, to be able to wrap your head around it being as much fun, you're just not going to know until you get out there and experience it. And it is a blast. I mean, you feel like, you were part of the success of the hunt, as the cameraman. Of course, you don't get the kudos and slap on the back. It's the hunter, but for that kind of experience, man, it's awesome to be able to go back and watch the footage again and critique yourself on what you could do better and different the next time. And
exactly.
It's a lot of fun. I couldn't agree with you more.
It's not for everybody, but if you want to extend your season, fine. If you're going with and helping a buddy, just grab a handy cam and take it with at least. It doesn't have to be like this DSLR stuff that we're making. GoPro makes some amazing stuff right now. I mean, just take something to where you have something to look back at with your buddies and look at it. That first Alaska trip with Randy and Darren and Greg, man, they hated having that camera around. They hated having me looking at it. They didn't want to talk to it. Right. And then I said that, you know, a couple months later, got back, put the film together, sent it over to them. They're like, oh man, that is so awesome. I'm so glad you did it. I'm so glad we put with you doing that. Right. Because this is the coolest thing, and they were sending it to all their buddies.
Yeah,
so
and then really and then they're kicking themselves for not participating more. And
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, as a hunter too. I mean, not just as a cameraman, as a hunter, when you get back and then you, you know, you see the finished product and you realize, man, okay, if I'd have done this or that or whatever, then it would have, you know, made it turn out that much better. And it's pretty incredible the projects that guys are putting out these days and just how I think there's a real positive benefit for hunting when you look at what guys are putting out here for the most part compared to what was, you know, being shown 15, you know, 10, 15, even 5 years ago, really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the camera gear just keeps getting better. And then the guys that are running it keeps getting better. And at this point, it blows my mind. I can still turn on the TV and find a crappily produced and a crappily shot TV right. show, but they're out there. Like there's a ton of them with all gear and everybody's knowledge is out there. It's just getting better. It's awesome.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, each time somebody puts out, you know, really high quality product and somebody that's kind of up and coming that has, you know, skills or is willing to learn, sees that and it just kind of keeps raising the bar and you know, each time people are putting out more and better content.
Exactly. There's a few guys that I watch that I just, you know, I try to learn something new every time, picking it up and try to aspire to be like that. And just, I just don't watch anything else, so I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the storytelling and all that. It's, people are doing an amazing job.
Yeah, I agree.
For sure. Right on, Lane. Well, I appreciate your time again. We're having a hard time logging off here. They're going down different tangents and all that, but
I think we could do it for another couple hours if we wanted to, but sure. I don't know if anybody wants to stick on here and hear it that long.
Right on. Well, again, I appreciate your time and I'll have to get back with you, if not before season next year, then certainly after to kind of get a recap from you.
Sounds good, man.
Good deal. All right. Thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so that new episodes will automatically be downloaded to your device as soon as they become available. And while you're on iTunes, please take the time to give us a review. This will help us in the iTunes rankings and will help the podcast grow. Share it with your friends on social media. If you've got a topic that you would like to see covered or a guest that you'd like to hear from on a future episode, email it to South or Cody at info@thewesternbowhunterpodcast.com. Thank you for listening.
Memories of time spin away, vanish into the sun.
GoHunt.com. Our goal is to be the very best at what we do. We are constantly putting value and new information at our users' fingertips. It's our job to always go above and beyond for our customers. We don't want you to stress days of researching or paying hunting consultants to give you unreliable and opinionated information before your hunt. That's why we're giving you the power and ability to find exactly what you want when you want it. And with the introduction of draw odds and filtering 2.0, it's never been easier. So why wait? Join the movement today and start finding the perfect hunt for you. Go Hunt Insider, the new breed of hunter. Visit GoHunt.com/insider and join the movement.